Welcome to Seasons of Sobriety. This is a podcast where you can join in the journey of other recovering alcoholics and addicts. You will be on the road with them as you listen to how each person came into recovery and how they persevered through times of anger, sadness, fear, and joy. I am your host, Howard M. I am here to share my own experience as well as the experience of other recovering brothers and sisters. I am so grateful you have decided to join me today. So I would like to welcome the listeners to today's episode of Seasons of Sobriety. I'm talking today with Scott H. from Baltimore, Maryland. Scott has been sober since November of 1984. Scott and I met in 1996 when I took a new job in the Baltimore area, and I had asked him to be my sponsor shortly after meeting him. I would say my understanding of the Fellowship of the Spirit as described in our 10th step began as my relationship with Scott developed. When I moved away in 2001 to the New Jersey area, Scott did his best to counsel me until I found a new sponsor. We have remained very good friends, and I still seek his counsel from time to time on life's challenges and recovery. I know his story will be of tremendous benefit to those listening. So welcome, Scott, to Seasons of Sobriety, and thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
You're welcome.
Yes, I've been looking forward to this since we spoke a few weeks ago. So what I'd like you to do is, could you take us back to November of 1984 and describe what made you walk through that meeting door?
My father had gotten sober in April of 1981. So there is a dynamic in a family. When one alcoholic gets sober, the other remaining alcoholics start to be recognized or noticed. And that was a situation I encountered for the next 2.5 years. November of 1984, it was Thanksgiving. I was at my aunt's home, and I was at the end of my drinking and using drugs, but did not know it that evening. But that Thanksgiving, I was hitting a bottom on a Thursday evening, to which I then, over the next 72 hours, continued to use until that Monday, November 25th of 1984, when I entered my first AA meeting.
Okay, so this was your very first AA meeting. You had not tried AA before this?
I had not tried AA myself. I had gone to my father's first anniversary in April of 1982, and if you were to ask me what I remember of that meeting, I could tell you it was in a room with tables and people.
Okay, good. Good. Nice memory. So you're going into your first meeting, you know, they go through whatever they go through in that first meeting. And what makes you decide that, yeah, I'm going to keep going, I'm going to go to a second meeting and so forth?
Well, I'll preface it by the first meeting's condition was I was 22 at the time, out of college, unemployed, and I would probably say unemployable. And my mother and father basically said to me, a condition in which you can continue to live in our home is you must go to an AA meeting with your father.
Okay.
Now, I will tell you, what I heard was an AA meeting. So, Monday, I went to a... Yes.
One. Okay.
One meeting. And so, I went to a lunch meeting with my father. It was near his office at the time. And I walked into this meeting, and I honestly thought walking into the meeting, because it was in a hotel, not a church, I thought it was in the restaurant where we would be at a table. I didn't know how meetings really functioned. And somehow we were going to be eating lunch in a restaurant, and an AA meeting was going to go on.
While you're chomping down.
Yeah. And they escorted us to the basement of the hotel where the meeting was held. And that's where I heard the first message of AA recovery. And I actually listened.
Very nice. Very nice. So now you're in AA for a little while. A few months, and you're looking around. And so what's going? What's changing? Why, you know, what are you doing at this point now that you've been in for a few months?
I became extremely active quickly in that I went to a meeting every day. I became engaged with the fellowship, the 12 steps. I got a sponsor in the program who was very step-oriented. And I think what attracted me was I had always been searching for something to give me stability in my life. And this was the first tangible thing I felt, not in my head, but in my whole body. This is different. And I kept going to meetings regularly. I became an institution. I would go to a lot of institution meetings. And I believe that my relationship with God was reignited in my early months of sobriety.
Very nice. Yeah, that actually leads to my next question is, were you brought up with any type of religion or the God of your understanding as a child at all? Was there anything instilled in you growing up?
Yeah, that's a great question in the sense that I was not raised in that traditional Catholic family that knew all the rote prayers. I recall as a young child with my mom saying, "And now I lay me down to prayer sleep."
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Now I lay me down to sleep prayer. It was a prayer that I did with my mom, and I loved that with my mother. What I loved about that was I loved being with my mom as I was going to bed at night, saying a prayer to God. It just brought me peace. And this was as a young 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old boy. I was not raised in a traditional church-going family. I think when I was about 10 or 11, my parents said, "Do you want to go anymore?" I said, "No," and they stopped taking me.
Okay.
And so I was not raised in a traditional religious home, but I will say that I sought a relationship with God as a young boy, but it was in a very informal sense.
Well, it does sound like when you were praying with your mom that it did start a connection either with the God of your understanding or even your mother. Like it started to develop there and sounded like you really, really appreciated having that connection.
Yes. I would say that it was, as we have referred to it in recovery, a conscious contact.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There was definitely, I had that as a young boy. And again, this was all prior to my beginning to use alcohol and drugs.
Right, right. So let's explore that a little bit. So now you're in AA and you said you're getting into the steps, but you, at some point between 5, 6 years old, abandoned God and now you're reconnecting. What did that look like for you? How can you parse the little details on that for me?
Yeah. When I was in treatment, I was with a guy who was raised in a Catholic home, Catholic school, and I thought he had like the secret.
Mm.
And so I remember saying to him, "What is this God thing, prayer? You know, how do I get a conscious contact with God?" And I thought he was going to say, "Here are the three prayers you need to recite every day." And all he said to me was, "Why don't you get on your knees and talk to him?"
The simplicity of that, right?
I was like, Howard, sir, I was like, no, it's that easy. And I began to do that. And for almost the entire 34 and a half years I've been sober, every morning I'm on my knees praying, and every night I'm on my knees praying before I go to bed.
Wow. That's great. That's great. Yeah. The simplicity of, I think actually we were on a retreat that barefoot's footsteps in the sand or something. Footprints in the sand. Yeah. And so we were at this retreat and I think I heard the retreat master, he got real secretive and quiet. And he says, I have this secret. Do you want to know how to pray? And we're all like kind of leaning in and listening. And he says, often. And we're all just like, wow. Yeah. But you know, we were hanging on just like you're saying, like, oh, there's got to be some magical thing from this priest. And it's like, no. There really isn't. It's you know, establishing a relationship. I mean, I have a relationship with you that would not happen if I didn't keep contacting you, right?
Right.
Yeah. Same thing. Yes. with God. So, all right. Very good.
And Howard, I don't know if you remember in your early sobriety, but for me, I remember times when I would be working and fear would begin to fill me. And I remember consciously sometimes reaching my hand out and just saying a prayer and asking God to hold my hand and help relieve me of this fear, and it would be tangibly removed.
Yeah, I would say something as simple as, okay, God, I don't know what to do, and I'm hoping you do, and I'm just gonna move on from there. Yeah, just these little things that just pushed you along, right?
Yes.
So what was the name of that first sponsor you said who got you into the steps?
Spence.
Oh, that's right, Spence. And how did you pick Spence?
Spence had what I wanted. Spence had a confidence and an air about him that I wanted to have in my life. I also saw that Spence had already worked the 12 steps. He was active in the program, and he wasn't just talking about the program. I saw actions in what he was doing at different meetings I would go to. And so I was like, okay, how do I go about asking this man to be my sponsor? And I remember it was after a meeting in a parking lot. I felt like I was asking a girl to the prom.
Right.
I was like, because I was so nervous. And I remember kicking stones in a parking lot by his feet. And he looked at me and he goes, Scott, what do you want to ask me? And I said, Spence, will you be my sponsor? And he taught me something that I still do to this day. He said, let's go have coffee and talk about it so you can understand what I do as a sponsor and what I expect of a pigeon.
And he was doing you a service by doing that, wasn't he?
A great service.
Right. And just instead of just saying yes, and you don't know what to expect or what to do, and invariably misunderstandings happen and resentment starts to build, and that's not the kind of relationship you want with someone who either who you sponsor or who you have as a sponsor.
No, I believe that was a great insight for me and future men that I would sponsor that I still do to this day.
Yeah. Now, because I know Spence is not your sponsor today, and one of the things that I want the message of this podcast is that sponsorship evolves and it changes. And can you talk a little bit about your evolution of sponsorship and kind of where you are today with it, with your sponsor now, and how that came about?
Yeah, like through the, I moved a couple times in my sobriety. So by physical location, I was always taught that you must have a sponsor that you can put your eyes on and sees you at meetings. So I went up to Williamsport, Pennsylvania for early part of my sobriety, had a sponsor, came back to Baltimore, got another sponsor down here, then moved to another part of the area of Baltimore and got a different sponsor there. And then I met you. Mm-hmm. And you and I, in our 12th year of my sobriety, met, we got to know each other, and you asked me to sponsor you. And I, in turn, said, well, I respect your recovery, and you sponsored me. And that retreat down at the ocean, if you recall, a lot of the work you and I did was what took me to the next level of emotional sobriety so that I could then meet my wife, Judy, and marry her, and have been with her for 20 years, 18 years in September, married, with a 16-year-old and almost 14-year-old daughters. And I'll never forget that what you said to me was the work we're going to do is going to prepare you to meet the kind of woman and make you the man God always intended you to be.
Wow. I don't remember as well as you do, I guess. But thank you for sharing that with me. That means a lot. And I'm so happy for you, and what you have built as a father and a husband over the years. We came up with this little expression, I think, one alcoholic convincing another alcoholic to take actions he doesn't yet believe in to become a man he never thought he could be. And yeah, we mixed it up pretty good there. I think it catapulted me as well. So I think to be with someone who's willing to be as vulnerable as you were willing to be, and to just dig into the the ground glass of our recovery, you know, of all the shattered pieces, and just be willing to get cut up a little bit, you know?
And so to close that circle, I am now being sponsored by a man named Gary. And I read this in the 10th step. It talks about the type of sponsorship I have today is one in which I do spot checks. Mm-hmm. I'm meeting with my sponsor, Gary, tomorrow, Thursday. So I'm not trying to do a fourth step, you know, fearless and moral inventory. I'm with Gary to go in there and just say, hey, here's what's happened since the last time we met. And I just want to go over a couple things. Here's a hot topic I may have. Can we review that? Because I may be off base. Sponsorship today with Gary is one in which Gary knows me. He's not a crisis center, you know, in the sense that I stay in touch with him regularly.
Right.
And he keeps me on track. And he helped me dramatically over the last year deal with situations with my father, who was, again, still sober, but suffering from grave depression, and dealing with another family member. That person transitioned out of a business we're in together, and having that dynamic occur in a family with a business and money, Gary walked me through that with grace and dignity.
Mm. And just listening to you talk about that, because I'm sitting here thinking, okay, and I do this too. You know, it's like I got 30 years and I talk with my sponsor on the phone on Wednesdays and I meet face to face with him on Saturdays. I mean, unless something, you know, some event, but that is, you can almost set your watch by something like that. And you're here with me 34 years and you're spot checking with your sponsor, and it's great because we got stuff going on today that we never had before. Right.
What's the one thing you taught me, Howard? Always remain teachable.
Always remain teachable. Yeah, I did.
That's what you told me.
Yep. You can't go wrong doing that.
Nope.
Good. Yeah, that's great. And you know, there's a part of me that's a little jealous of Gary. I'll say that. Like, I miss that relationship. I do. And we just have something different now, but it's, you know, it really was really nice. So, okay. So
I loved it.
Yeah. When we hear in meetings, you know, that our primary purpose is to help the alcoholic who still suffers, I think there's a little myth that that's the newcomer, because I know we have both been the alcoholic who still suffers with 5, 10, 15, 20 years of sobriety. And is there a point in your recovery you feel comfortable talking about, you know, when you felt, you know, you were the alcoholic who still suffered and you needed everybody?
I was 9 years sober.
Mm-hmm.
I had become complacent in my recovery, and I started to slide back with behaviors that were of alcoholic personality traits, lying, cheating, stealing. And I had a couple of men come to me and basically said, Scott, we are deeply concerned with what we've been witnessing over the past few months to probably about 6 months. And they did somewhat of a intervention and got me some additional outside help. And if I were to sum up all that help, what it basically was, Scott, get back to basics. You forgot where you came from.
Right. And since then, has there been any other times that has where, you know, even if you're not sliding back in the step work, life has its bumps in that road. And are there other times where it's like, I don't know what to do. And I got to sit at the meeting and sit with the newcomers and just absorb what's going on, because I don't have a clue here.
I mean, I could say I was divorced in AA.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I will tell you, you know, after my ex-wife moved her portion of the furniture out of the house, which basically was the living room and the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
And I came home from a meeting and walked into my living room and dropped to the floor and started crying, going, I don't know what to do. I'm lost. And it was, if you remember at that time, I don't know if I had met you yet. I think I met you a couple years after that, because that was around 94.
Right. We met in 96.
Yeah. Right. I met a group of guys that we then met, because remember, we were playing cards. We used to play spades, was it?
Either spades or hearts or, yeah, one of those, but yes.
Hearts, right. That, those men basically pulled me up and, you know, just said, Scott, just show up. You're going to get through this, but it is not going to be easy nor fast. And they very slowly helped me get back to, you know, feeling as if there was going to be joy again in my life. And that was very important because, you know, left to my own devices, I don't know that I would have fought back as hard as quickly without these men in AA showing up, calling me, you know, taking me to meetings and getting me back involved in AA. And also, I'd say in business, you know, besides personal relationships, you know, when business events occur, I own a small business and have for the last 25 years. And I can tell you, there are events that rocked my financial foundation. And, you know, I had to do some serious gut checks about, you know, what is important, what is a priority, make sure you're still going to meetings, make sure you're still active in your institution meetings. Because what I found was, is when these moments in life occur, at the time they happen, it feels as if they're going to last forever.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And I've come to find that these are just temporary bumps.
Very nice. Yeah, the you were saying, so I, because I have also been divorced, and, you know, I met my first wife when I was about 10 years sober, or maybe 9 or 10 years sober. And you know, when things were spiraling out of control, you know, I'll say I'm very grateful you went through a divorce in sobriety to help me go through a divorce in sobriety. Because I had a lot of shame around that I really thought I had all the tools as a, you know, recovering man and, you know, 10 years in the program. And the reality was that I didn't have the skills I needed that were really needed to be a husband. And you helped me go to the bitter end of working things out with my first wife. And I think you had told me that, look, if this doesn't work out, you're going to be a better man for your next wife. So you have to work on it sometime. And because otherwise you stay the same. So I thank you for that. And as you know, I got married back in 2010. So that's been 9 years to my current wife. And it's just been wonderful. So like you, you know, my wife and she has a son from a first marriage, and they've never seen me drink. Your wife and your children have never seen you drink. You know, we have that blessing. They've seen us act like an alcoholic, but they haven't seen us drink. Right? I mean, because...
Well, I will tell you, Judy has said to me in some discussions, I can't talk to the alcoholic right now.
Right, right.
And that's a gut check to basically say, why don't you call Gary your sponsor? My wife will call her Al-Anon sponsor, Karen, and then let's talk later. That's a big change in how I used to handle situations and relationships.
Right, because it used to be pouting and screaming and all that. So
yeah, basically, I want to talk about it right now. Even if you don't, we're going to, and we all know where that ends up.
Yeah, being a bully, right?
And yes.
That just, I notice that doesn't really tie the ladies, you know, create intimacy between me and my wife.
I have learned the same.
So this is something that I like to ask about. So is there an amends that did not go well? Like, I know I've had a few where someone's, you know, I'm talking to them and the look in their eye is like, anytime you're finished, you can go. And it's just that, you know, I've cleaned my side of the street, but just they're not in it with me.
One, I'll also preface this by saying, I recommend to all men I sponsor, before you ever make an amends, let me know beforehand so we can talk about it to make sure you're ready to make an amends.
Right, right.
Which leads me to an amend I wanted to make because it came up in my fourth and fifth step with my sponsor to someone I knew in college. And I wanted to go make the amends. And unbeknownst to my sponsor, I drove back to where I went to college to meet with this person and her parents and knocked on the door unannounced. And when they opened the door, the mother and father, you know, they were, the look on their face was almost like, why are you here? I explained to them what I was doing. And I think they were polite, but still not ready to hear from me in person. They then called their daughter down because I said I wanted to make amends to her. She stood at the top of the stairs, stared at me. I tried to make my amends, and she rolled her eyes and basically walked back into her room and shut her door. Now, I had in a vision in my 3-hour drive up to this home how grateful they were going to be that I was there and had cleaned up my life. What I didn't realize, the damage I had done was still too raw. And had I sought my sponsor's advice, he may have said, one, contact them prior to going up there to see if they want to see you. And so you can see how self-will can still run riot. And I basically almost bombarded this family who was still, the wound was wide open and gaping, and they were not ready, nor did they have any idea I was showing up. It was just a very selfish act on my part. I drove home those 3 hours not feeling good about myself, got home to my sponsor, told him what I had done, and he very politely but sternly let me know that is in no way a ninth step.
Right. Yeah. Have you done it like that since, Scott?
Nope.
Oh, okay, good. Yep. Yeah. All right. So let's look at it from the other side now. How about an amends where you said this is not going to go well, and then it really turned into something beautiful?
Mm.
Take your time to think. It's okay.
No, I have one, but it still brings back emotions because I won't go into any of the circumstances of what occurred between this ex-girlfriend of mine. But when I saw her, it was at a recycling center. And I remember seeing her from across the parking lot. And I had done a lot of work with my sponsor. And actually, there was this one. And then I'm going to go to another one. So I saw her across the parking lot. My sponsor said, if you ever run into her, make your amends.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I remember walking up to her and her eyes kind of opened like, oh, it's Scott. That's Scott there. And I walked up and I started to tell her. I talked to her and I made my amends. And I remember all she did was put her arms around me and go, she's like, Scott, I'm just so glad you cleaned up your life and got better.
Mm. Very nice.
I expected her to still be angry and hurt and... But the most poignant amends I ever made in my life was my first wife and how that whole relationship broke apart. I remember the work I was doing with my sponsor was you. And I remember you made me dig deep and you made me look at what were the character defects that I did, not anything about what she did. And I remember at the ocean, I was in a hotel bed with the covers up to my head, begging you to stop and not make me go any deeper. And I remember that poignant moment where I said, what do I have to do to be different? And you said, you have to admit everything. You can't be the guy that gets to be looking good, because that was one of my masks I would wear. And you said, you have to tell her the truth. And I remember sitting there and I completely surrendered. And I said, I will do whatever you suggest so that I can get better and change. And when I went and made that amends, Howard, it was anticlimactic to all the work we did prior. All the work I needed to do was in that room in Ocean City. I surrendered. That was the most poignant amends I've ever made.
Wow. Yeah, I remember that. I remember the covers you brought them up to your nose. And yep. You were like, yeah, no more. And I said, just a little more.
No.
And we did it. Yep. We did it. I do think it's kind of funny that the first one you talked about was at a recycling center. You know, the kind of the spiritual irony of all that where, I got to recycle something here besides a couple of bottles. Yeah. Okay, so this other question here says, our 12-step talks about practicing the principles in all our affairs. Can you recall a recent incident where it was tempting to regress to old behavior, yet you opted for the dignity and grace of the principles of the program?
Okay, so having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I would say when my sister was leaving the business in April of 2018, we had hit an impasse. I knew she wanted to retire, but her timing and mine were different. And I remember going to my sponsor, Gary, and I remember saying to him, I want her out today. And I remember him saying, Scott, you don't get that choice. You have to sit down with your sister, your business partner, and you two have to work this out and not do what you want to do. And I'll be honest, I walked out of his office and said, he doesn't understand.
Right. He doesn't understand. It's different.
Yes. And I remember by the time I got back to my office, I remember walking into my office and asking my sister, when do you want to retire? Instead of me saying, you're done as of this date. And she goes, I'm going to go home and talk to my husband. And she came back the next day and she ended up leaving the business a year earlier than she originally wanted, 8 months after the date I wanted. And we both, on December 28th of 2018, when she left the business for the last day as an employee and my partner, we cried and hugged each other. Hmm. That was as a result of practicing these principles in all my affairs.
Yeah, doing it the right way.
And I still have a relationship with my sister. If I had done what I wanted, I don't believe that would have been the case.
Right. Absolutely not. Yeah. Because, you know, somehow people remember what we did last. They don't remember all the stuff that we did prior to that stupid or careless thing.
Right.
Okay. Well, good. Thank you for that. That was good. So what do you think is a part of your story you believe people need to hear? So experience that may not typically be talked about at the average meeting because, you know, you go to a topic meeting or big book meeting, you know, there's something that you're like, you know, I don't hear this talked about and I'd like to talk about it. So I'd like to give you this space to do that.
It's a little multifaceted for me. I would say that one of the things I would like to hear more of is under any and all circumstances life puts in or has us encounter, We don't have to drink to get through them. I often hear, it scares me, I hear people say, well, I drank because I lost my mother suddenly, or I went through a divorce, or I got fired. I would like to hear people speak more about, listen, that life hurdle hit me square between the eyes, but I did everything my sponsor told me, and I worked through it and didn't pick up a drink to get through that situation. I don't hear that enough. I don't hear people talk about that. I hear people talk about how they drank over a situation and they're grateful to be back. I don't hear enough of people talking about how they got through these things and didn't pick up a drink.
Got it.
And I'm curious if people are afraid to say that because, you know, are they going to sound arrogant? Are they going to sound pompous? Instead of saying that under any and all circumstances, alcohol is not a choice. That's one that just came up for me.
Yeah, because and thank you. That's a great point. The one that I seem to kind of crave to hear about is about life cycles. In other words, me and you, we've sat through the Big Book together. I've sat with through people with hundreds of times, and it doesn't necessarily say, "Oh, when you get married," "Oh, when you have a child," or in my case, "Oh, when you are into a blended family and you have a stepchild," or "Oh, now your parents are ill and they're dying or they're dead," or "Now you're getting older and you have to plan for your life." You know, all these different things that, I mean, because there's people in the program that I know are getting older, so we've been through it, but it's just not a regular topic. Even our mortality, it's something I think about. And what legacy am I leaving at this point or in 10 years or 20 years? And that's something I wish we could talk a little more about than, you know, "Oh, I came in 20 years ago and it's gotten so much better." Okay, that's nice. What now? How about going forward?
That's a great question.
Yeah. Just one of these things.
Did you come up with that on your own?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
When I was doing that. Very intuitive.
To talk about other things, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just because we go to these meetings and they get a little, all right, I know, okay, I'm going to a third step meeting, I'm going to beginner. Okay. So I know what we're kind of going to talk about, or someone brings up a topic and it's like, well, this is what I want to talk about and no one's talking about it. So yeah. So that's why I thought it was a good question to have in there. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, this is one of my favorite things that we talk about. So you talked about your sponsor. Let's talk about your sponsoring people, right? And laugh about that expression. Sponsorship is inconvenient. Can you talk about, I'd like you to talk about the inconvenience of sponsorship.
I think you and I, when we were, at least my recollection of how we would reference it was, you know, the midnight phone call, the during the work day phone call, when someone was truly in need of help from their sponsor at a time when it's like, I have so much on my plate. How am I going to be able to take this call or get in my car and drive over to their home? And it's not cliche. Every time I did it, I came home feeling better, feeling freer, feeling more connected to God, those times when it was inconvenient. And right now, I got a guy who has been around for about 10 years, but hasn't gone through the steps. And while it's what's happening, in the sense I've gone through the 12 steps, but my ninth year, my complacency has put this man in his, remember the term we used to use, we're up in the tree, can you help me come down? Do you remember that term?
Yeah, talk each other out of the tree. I do, yep.
Right. Talk each other out of the tree. So this guy is going through that right now. He was up in his tree, mm-hmm. and he called me and reached out to me because he had asked me to sponsor him about 5 or 6 years ago. And we had the discussion. I kind of told him, this is how I do things. Absolutely, I'm on board. Well, it came out that he didn't want to do the work. He wanted to go to meetings occasionally and get all the benefit. And when he reached out to me, he is now engaged, involved, and ready to do anything I suggest. And he and I just tried to get together to do some step work, and our schedules are so mixed up. But that's the inconvenience part, that we're going to figure out a time to get together. You know, he's got two young kids and a wife. I've got kids and a wife. We both have jobs.
Time constraints.
That are demanding.
Yeah.
Yep. But we both know that, and I said this, if you truly want to be engaged and work this recovery program, I'm all in.
Yeah.
And he's all in. But I'll be the first to tell you, Howard, I will not, if somebody asks me to do an AA commitment, just say yes without checking my schedule with my wife, my kids. I think that's been a misinterpreted
myth.
I can't suddenly just say, yes, I'll do it. And then, oh no, I'm not taking my daughter to school today.
Yeah.
I have obligations and commitments that sobriety has given me, and I know how to prioritize them.
Very good. There are many other books that I have read over the years that I have gotten a lot out of, have been applied to my recovery, that aren't AA literature. For instance, one of them, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey. I think that was the very first one I read. I was 40 years old and not doing well at my job. And my boss suggested I read this book. And it really, I think, catapulted my principles of AA as well. And another one I like is called Lynchpin by Seth Godin, that helped me be someone who was very helpful. And I won't say I made myself irreplaceable at a job, but it helped me to make myself be someone who would be missed rather than someone where they say, oh, we're glad you're leaving, that kind of thing. So is there any books that, besides the big book and 12 of 12, that have helped you and that you have infused into your recovery that you'd like to share?
I will say, early in my recovery, I remember somebody recommending a book by Robert Fulghum, Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten.
Oh, yeah, that one.
I'm not going to say it was in depth, but it was simplistic yet impactful.
How so?
Well, it just talked about, there was one thing I remember in it is, if you borrow something, put it back from where you got it.
Right. How simple, you know, is that?
I mean, just stuff like that. It was little vignettes like that that just kind of were like, wow, that really is just a great way to live life. He talked about how he had a neighbor, or maybe the neighbor, liked his lawn manicured. He liked to keep his lawn very natural. And he talked about how the dynamic between he and his neighbor, and how they each came to peace with the other, realizing that neither was wrong.
Right. Seeking to understand rather than being understood. Right? That kind of thing.
Kind of like St. Francis of Assisi.
Right. Yeah, of course, I used to be the antonym of St. Francis, you know, where there is, you know, where there is peace, I will bring despair. And, you know, where there is, you know, happiness, I will bring sorrow. I want you to think back 10 years ago. So you're 24 years sober. Okay. And now you're 34 and you're looking back at the guy 24. What do you tell him? What do you say? Hey, keep this in mind. Don't lose sight of this.
It kind of goes back, I'll say 10 years, but say 16 when Taylor was born.
Okay.
I remember telling my sponsor that Judy and I were pregnant with our first child. I remember the bench we were sitting on in Towson outside the courthouse because he was an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the elation he felt for us and how happy he was that we were going to be parents. And, you know, after hugging and, you know, just some tears of joy, he looked at me with this cold, hard stare and said, don't you ever forget where you came from. He goes, you now are sober. You have a job, a wife, a business, really dear friends in your life. You have everything that AA had promised you. Don't you dare walk away from the program now that you're about to have a child. And I remember saying to him after the fact, why did you say that? He goes, Scott, think of how many people that come into this program and get to that point, their lives become busy and AA becomes inconvenient.
Right. The 12 steps or the recovery process is no longer the chandelier from which your life suspends. That's how I like to think of it.
Right. And Howard, those words like hit me in the marrow of my bone because I was like, my God, he's right. How many people have I seen who got their lives back and did everything that was suggested and then walked away from it and said, I don't need that anymore. I've got it. So what would I say to him? I would say to him, Scott, please don't forget where you came from. Always remain teachable. Continue to work this program. Those are the things I would have to always remind him of.
Very good. Two more things here. I have some quotes from pages in our literature, and I'd like you to comment on them. So the first one here says, when you hear the line in the Big Book, it says, a man is unthinking when he says sobriety is enough.
A man is unthinking when sobriety is enough?
When he says sobriety is enough. He's like the farmer where the wind has kept blowing.
Right.
And, you know, it comes out and says, oh, there's, you know, the wind stopped blowing. Everything's fine now.
Ain't it grand, the wind stopped blowing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that alcohol is but a symptom of my problem. Now, that's what I have found is my alcoholism can become alive and well without a mind-altering substance in my body. So, you know, it's almost as if you're looking at sobriety one-dimensionally. I believe it's multidimensional. It's, you know, I think they say that for a reason, that it's physical, mental, and spiritual, because physical sobriety alone is, to me, too one-dimensional and empty.
Yeah. Okay, and one more. Herbert Spencer. You had to know it was coming.
Oh, the educational variety.
There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. What do you think of that?
I have Roman numeral number 2, dog-eared in my Big Book, in my hands right now. Yep. How many times could you and I each say, and I'll speak for myself in this, where I was absolutely certain I already knew the answer to the situation, only to find out that I was blind to the other points of view, the other side of the equation. And I will say that I've gotten much better at this.
I have gotten
much better at this. I don't have it conquered, but I'm much better. I'm much faster to recognize it, and I don't go as deep in the weeds as I used to.
Yeah, it's good.
I thought you were going to read, most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time.
Ah. So you want to talk about that one?
I didn't have a burning bush. I didn't have an epiphany. You know, my relationship with God is still evolving to this day. To articulate my relationship with God, I don't say this for out of ignorance or out of arrogance. I'm not good at articulating what my relationship with my God is, but I will tell you, I feel it. I absolutely feel my relationship with God, and it's real.
Yeah, well, I've watched you live as a result of a relationship with God. So it's there without the words. So yeah, you're right. In comment to what you were saying, someone had sent this to me. They said, I'd like to change that line. You will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. He said, I think it should read, you will no longer handle situations in the worst possible way. So I thought you'd like that. All right. So I think we've spent a lot of good time together, gotten a lot of good things out. But I do want to leave things open right now. If there's anything you would like to talk about that I didn't ask about, I want to give you a place to do that.
I'll close with this. Without AA, I would not have met certain people in my life. And to think a Gentile like me from Maryland, who met a Jewish man from Chicago, from Normal, Illinois, in our paths would have never crossed had you and I not gone into the despair and depths of alcoholism to then end up in Maryland together. And here we are, Howard, 23 years later. Every time you and I talk, it's as if we've been seeing each other regularly every week.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a real gift.
That is a gift, Howard, that you and I understand how our relationship operates, and yet it still has depth, even with distance.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. That's wonderful.
Yep.
So I'll just, and I'll say thank you. I said, you know, Scott, this was just a wonderful experience, walking a little bit down memory lane and actually finding out some things about you that I didn't know about. And being part of your life, like you said, for the past 23 years has, you know, truly been a blessing for me. And, you know, when I see your name pop up on my phone, I, you know, a smile's always there. I'm like, oh, cool, it's Scott. And that is a good feeling. So, yeah, thank you very much for spending time with me. And I just want to say to the audience, thank you once again for taking the time to listen to the podcast, Seasons of Sobriety. We will hopefully be in touch soon.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
We have come to the end of this episode of Seasons of Sobriety. I trust that you were able to identify with the personal story of our guest and perhaps apply some of their experience to give you the hope needed to persevere through your own journey. A special thanks to Nick Marcos, who has generally given his time and talent composing the music of this episode. This podcast has been completely self-funded. If you believe today's episode has been beneficial, I ask that you contribute a little more this week to your home group or other meetings, perhaps $5 or $10 if you can spare it. Until next time, remember, if you have trouble practicing the principles of the steps in all your affairs, you may have too many affairs.